compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's go. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends, tell them to download the Relevant Radio app and get on board. The number to call, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. And please remember, our special Holy Week programming continues Friday at noon Central. That's tomorrow, as we broadcast the Stations of the Cross live with Bishop Robert McClory from the Shrine of Christ Passion in St. John, Indiana. And on Saturday, Holy Saturday, we will broadcast the Easter Vigil Mass live from the Vatican with the Pope at 1:30 p.m. Central. You'll find a guide to all of our special Holy Week programming at relevantradio.com. Now, real quick before we go back to the phone calls, I have a note that came in a few minutes ago from Nicole, and she's listening on the Relevant Radio app asking about meat on Holy Thursday. Can we eat meat on Holy Thursday? Please advise. Thank you very much, and have a happy and holy Easter week, or Easter. Thank you for that, Nicole. Yes, you may eat meat today if you wish. The days of the year that are proscribed from eating meat would be all the Fridays during Lent, beginning with Ash Wednesday, and then all the subsequent Fridays during Lent, including Good Friday. So tomorrow, even though tomorrow technically is outside of Lent, it's in the liturgical little mini season known as the Triduum, the 3 days, at the end of Holy Thursday leading up to Easter Sunday. That's technically Lent is over, but Good Friday is another one of those days of abstaining from meat. So you're in the clear if you wish to have meat today. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to Nolan in Jacksonville. We ran out of time, Nolan. So for the sake of those who just tuned in and didn't hear you before we broke, you said you have a brother and sister-in-law who have started down the road of using IVF, in vitro fertilization. By way of preamble, you said that you and your wife were told, due to infertility issues, that you should do the same. This is going back some years, and you said no. And good for you that you said no to that. That's good. And you now have a couple of children, thanks be to God. So that was the background. And now you have a brother and sister-in-law who are progressing down that same road that you didn't go down of IVF, and that's where we got cut off. So you want to pick it up from there?
Yes, yeah. You got it all. My main question is just, obviously, I want to pray for those. I don't even know how to refer to my, you know, unborn nieces and nephews that are, for lack of a better term, you know, put on ice, obviously praying for them. But where I have two questions. One, I don't know how to pray for my brother and his sister, or my brother and sister-in-law, mm-hmm. As they go down this path, pray for success. Obviously I pray for God's will, but that feels so vague. And then my second question is, you know, my wife said that she doesn't think that it's a sin for them to do this because of their ignorance or their lack of knowledge of it being wrong. And, you know, I mentioned that my brother, just the same as me, grew up Catholic. He should know that this is wrong. But, you know, obviously in this, you know, time of desperation, I know how difficult it can be, how tempting it can be to use these technologies and move forward with the IVF.
Okay. Let's talk about that. So is he suggesting that ignorance is bliss, and that we can go forward, sort of blithely go forward with this because we don't really know much of anything, and we're going to kind of keep it that way so that we're not bothered by what the church teaches? Is that what he means?
I that's what I was saying, was that I think that he's got this ignorance, but I wouldn't say that, and I don't know. Okay. I don't think he would necessarily say that, but that's my wife's take on it, is that she thinks that because they don't know any better, it can't be a sin for them. And I was like, I don't have to think about that. And so,
yeah, well, let's start there. So the way to evaluate the morality of a human act involves the three foundations or fonts of the act. So you've got the object of the act itself, you know, what is it that's being done? You've got the circumstances, and you've got the intention. And if any one of those three, often it's more than one, sometimes it's all three, but if any one of them is wrong, then the whole thing is wrong. So you can think of it as red light, green light, like we do at the stop sign or at the stoplight. So if any one of those three things is a red light, then it's a no-go. If all three are green lights, then you can go. So in this case, the object of the act is the problem. It is, now there can be other problems with the other two, but the object of the act is the deliberate conception of a child through a means that is contrary to the meaning of marriage and human sexuality. And because, and this is not a topic for children, so parents, please, fair warning, turn the radio down or turn the radio or send the kids in another room, but please exercise prudence here. It's not for kids. Fair warning, ready, steady, go. So the God-ordained means of procreation is between one man and one woman in marriage. And the meaning of our very bodies and our reproductive systems as male and female are a guide to seeing that this is the manner in which God intends for conception to take place. Not in a test tube, not in a glass dish in a laboratory where some disinterested clinician is doing this. So it strikes at the very heart of the meaning of marriage and procreation. So even that unto itself is sufficient in itself to say this is an immoral action. And I can leave it at that. There are permutations on that theme, but we'll just leave it at that. So for him and his wife to sort of cocoon in this vague ignorance, one could say, well, it wouldn't be a sin for them. We can say with certitude that the act itself is sinful in a material sense. Now, how guilty would they be in a formal sense? Well, only God could know that. And my guess is that if they've talked to you and your wife, then they have at least some kind of hazy recognition that the church says that you shouldn't do this because it's immoral. So this gets to the question of conscience. And conscience is that voice inside each one of us through which God speaks to us and tells us that something is right or wrong. Even if you don't fully understand it, even if you don't have a clear idea of why this would be wrong, your conscience warns you that don't do this because there's something wrong with this. So we are obliged to obey our conscience. You are obliged to obey your conscience, but you're also obliged to properly form your conscience or to make a sincere effort to form your conscience. Somebody could say, well, I didn't know. Well, it doesn't mean it's not sinful, because it may very well be your own sinful fault that you did not properly form your conscience or seek to do so. That's the key right there. And how do we properly form our consciences? We turn to divine revelation. What does the Bible say? What does apostolic tradition say? What is the teaching of the church? How has God's law been revealed to us? And we all have a duty to seek to know those things. Some are better at it than others, but we have a duty to at least make an honest effort. So for them, it's not as simple to say, well, for them, it's not a sin because they didn't know. They should know, and they have a duty to know or to try to find out. So it's up to God to determine who's guilty of what. Certainly not up to me to make those deliberations, but it's not as though they're somehow off the hook because they're ignorant, especially because you and your wife are not ignorant and you've talked to them about this. So you are, in essence, awakening their consciences, and I would continue to try to do that. Now, I don't want to go on and on, but you said before the break that they have already now undertaken to, they have some ova that are now fertilized. Is that right?
Yes. When I spoke to my brother yesterday, they have, I can't remember, it's four or five fertilized eggs, and the plan is to go ahead and attempt an implantation this next cycle, the next few weeks.
And it's a terrible situation, but now they're in it. So here's what I would propose to you, that when you talk to them, I mean, obviously lead with love, lead with compassion, because you love them and you want to help them, but you're in a position to be able to guide them. And so I would tell them, number one, you don't have four or five fertilized eggs. You have four or five unborn children. These are your sons and daughters. We have to call these entities what they really are, who they really are. They're unborn children, unborn human beings. And it's important that they think in those terms, because if they don't, then it becomes easier to say, well, we want this one because the doctor says that genetically this, you know, this is a girl and this will have blue eyes or whatever, you know, whatever their requirements are. And then they're left with only a couple choices. One is that they pay to have the remaining embryos cryogenically stored indefinitely. Just think of what that would be like for a human being to be on ice in a lab somewhere forever and ever. Or they will, and they'll use terms like destroy or discard. Those are euphemisms. They kill the remaining embryos, typically. Or the third option now is really the only moral option that's open to them, and that is that successively they need to attempt to implant, and she needs to have implanted in her womb and to gestate each one of these children until they are all finally born. Anything less than that, it just further compounds the seriousness of this sin. And that's the predicament they now are in. They have three choices: indefinite freezing, killing the ones that they don't want, or making every effort to implant and gestate these children until they come to term and are born. Those are their options. And the third option is the only moral option for them.
Yeah.
Which is why, sorry to interrupt you, which is why people, please don't go down this road, because you get into this terrible predicament that these are the three options you're left with. None of them are good. Two of them are deeply, terribly sinful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we need to speak this truth to as widely as possible so the people don't make this fatal mistake, and I choose my words carefully here, by going down the road of IVF and then finding themselves with only these three options. Anything you want to add to that, Nolan? I need to press on.
No, I just thank you so much. I'm journeying through Exodus 90 right now, and so it's just been so nice to have something to listen to other than just Gregorian chants all day. I appreciate you.
Yeah. How was Exodus 90 for you? Did you achieve your goals?
It's been tough. We're not on schedule with everybody else. Group of guys started a couple weeks ago, and we're foster parents, and we have a 5-week-old newborn and a 6-year-old that's with us right now in our house. And so getting the holy hour and the nightly examine and the whole 8 hours of sleep, that's touch and go, but most everything else I'm able to keep up with.
Well, I admire you. And that, you know, that probably very well may be the kind of mental conditioning of your will to help prepare you for some of these things that you need to do, like talking to your brother and sister-in-law. I will pray that they will have ears to hear what you say. Thank you. And if you want, you can always send them a link to this conversation that we had right now. About an hour after the show is over, we post the entire show, so you could grab the link and email it or text it to them if you wanted to. Thank you. Let's go to Ruby now in Montana. Good morning, Ruby.
Good morning. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
I was just listening to what you were sharing, and first I wanted to thank you for using the, you know, choosing your words, and sometimes, you know, using the word kill is offensive to people, but we have to speak truth. And I just thought that was very brave and powerful. And so thank you for that. I have been raised, I wasn't really raised with any religious upbringing, but when I was 20, got very involved with non-denominational church and stayed there for almost 30 years. And
okay.
I left a couple of years ago. Just some things weren't making sense to me anymore. I find myself drawn to listening to messages such as yours. And there are just so many as I'm sure you know, doctrinal differences. And one in particular that I really struggle with is, you know, I guess the idea of a priest, and that, you know, as I've been taught, Jesus was the high priest, and that, you know, all of those sorts of very specific differences. And I don't know how to reconcile them. I find myself wanting to learn more, not just what I was told about, you know, the big bad Catholic Church, to be honest, but more so, I'm like, that has not been my experience. It's been teaching, but it has not been my experience. And I have several friends that are Catholic, and I've gone to a few masses. I don't always know, you know, the stand up, sit down, stop. I'm just being honest. Like, there's things that are practices that I don't know. And I can feel a resistance in me to learning more because I can't reconcile key points, but I want to. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I'm 52, and how do I learn? And is it even all that important at the end of the day anyway, if we're all saying that we're Christians? But I don't know how to reconcile things like, isn't Jesus the high priest? And if that's true, then what about all these other things? And how would you direct me?
Well, as you, as you're speaking, I'm thinking of what Jesus said to you and to me and all of us. He says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Mm-hmm. So maybe that could be a good Bible meditation. You know, Lord, I want to know the truth, and I want the truth to set me free. You promised me, Lord, that I can know the truth, and I want that. And even just that in itself as an intention, it's a beautiful, you know, reaching out toward him and toward the truth in a way that he's already promised that he wants that for you. So that might be one thing to meditate on. I'm also thinking of the father of the son who's he was possessed by a devil. This is in Mark 9, and Jesus casts out the devil. And I'm not in any way whatsoever equating that with you. So please don't connect. I'm not connecting those dots at all. But that's the context.
Yeah.
But the father, he, after seeing that Jesus is there, he says to him, I know you can do anything. Have pity on us. And if you can heal my son, please do so. And Jesus says, all things are possible to him who believes. And then immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. I've always really resonated with that passage. That's Mark 9:24. I believe, but help my unbelief in the ways that I'm lacking, Lord, in the ways that I don't really understand, or my belief is not where it should be. Help me in those areas. And that too could be part of your contemplation as we talk about these things. So those are two biblical thoughts for you. So what I would recommend is, seems that what you could use would be a good dose of a comprehensive overview of the different things that tend to separate evangelical Protestants and the Catholic Church. So whether it's Mary or sacraments or purgatory or things of that nature, there is a book, and I happen to have edited it, so I'm deeply familiar with it, but it's got 11 testimonies of different men and a woman who, like you, have lived their whole lives or most of their lives in evangelical Protestant Christianity. And they go through in their chapters what their objections to the church were and why they didn't believe this, why they didn't believe that. But they, what's neat about it, the book is called Surprised by Truth, by the way. It has a red cover.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So it has a red cover. It was published originally in 1994. And so each of these 11 stories will, I really believe, will be like a vitamin infusion, because over the course of the stories, you will find just about every single possible thing that you're wrestling with will be dealt with and responded to in a very interesting way, because the stories are fascinating. And there are all sorts of things in these stories that people, when they read them, they say, oh, that's exactly my situation. Or, yeah, I had the same thought. Or I I used to object in the same way. So if I can recommend any one thing other than listening to Relevant Radio, of course, please do keep listening.
Yeah.
But if you have a mind to, I would get that book, Surprised by Truth, red
cover.
Where
am I supposed to get it?
Any Catholic bookstore will sell it. You can get it online. You could order it online and on Amazon and have it tomorrow, that kind of thing, if you want.
Okay.
To.
Yeah. So all right. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the, I can concur with the gentleman who was talking before the last one when he was saying, you can feel it when you're talking, and that's the presence of the Holy Spirit. So it doesn't matter to me where it comes from. So thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you. And I appreciate you more than you know. All of you. I love you, man. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And you don't need to call or write in. The book I just mentioned is Surprised by Truth. It's the first one in the series, published in 1994, Surprised by Truth. I think you'll like it. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
This is just what I needed, Cyrus, FYI.
It's like magic?
It's like magic, but it's just what I needed. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Jan, waiting patiently in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Welcome.
My question is kind of piggybacking on the earlier caller about the Chrism Mass.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could take even a deeper dive into the actual oil combined with, I was at the Chrism Mass this past Tuesday with Bishop, and it looked to me that he was combining oil in different sacred vessels with, with something else, like a black or purple liquid.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And
I know what you mean.
Was the, yes. And then the other part of it was he mixed them, and then he, what I thought he did is breathe on them. So I was wondering if you could just take a deeper dive with that and what, in, you know, what was happening, and also are the oils different for each sacrament that they're used for? And I'll just put myself on mute and listen.
Okay, sounds good, Jen. I appreciate that. So simply put, the chrism oil that is consecrated by the bishop on at the Chrism Mass, it is a mix of olive oil and balsam. And balsam is probably what you saw as the darker of the two liquids. And that's what gives the aroma. It gives it as sort of a very beautiful quality. You can smell it. I mean, I was just at a confirmation last week, and the aroma of the chrism on the foreheads of the confirmandi is really beautiful. It's kind of like incense in a way in that regard. So that's what chrism oil is. And so when you see the confirmation, for example, that's what this is coming from. And that darker of the oils would be the balsam. Now, there are different, there are three different categories, you might say, of oils. So you have the oils of the oil, rather, of catechumens. You have the oil of the infirm, and that would be those who receive the sacrament of holy anointing, and then chrism. So the church's custom is, as I said earlier, to annually replenish the supply of these oils. The bishop is the one who does that, and then they're used for these different ministries. So I don't want to over-explain it, but that's the combination of olive oil and balsam that makes the chrism, and then those are the purposes that the oils are used for. Does that help? Oh, I guess Jan's still on mute. All right, Jan. Well, I hope that's helpful to you, and I do appreciate that. Thank you. How about Caroline now in Chicago? Good morning, Caroline.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, happy to.
So I have been struggling with infertility for a few years, and I'm seeing a NAPRO technology provider. She's Catholic. She recently recommended that I do acupuncture, so I have been doing it for like the last 6 months. Section where it lists, I guess, reasons for why you would say certain prayers, and one of them said acupuncture. And it didn't give any information on why that is listed there, but I started to have doubts that I am doing the right thing by going to acupuncture. So I just want to get your input on whether what the church, I guess, feels about acupuncture.
Sure. Well, that's a good question, Caroline. The church does not have a teaching, quote unquote, about acupuncture. In her moral theology, the church says that if there is a legitimate medical therapy that in itself is not immoral, so what would be an example of that? Let's say there was some medical therapy proposed to you. Let's say it was a gene therapy. And in order to receive the particular kind of therapy, it had to make use of the material from aborted babies, let's just say. So stem cells, this is something Michael J. Fox, the star of Family Ties and Back to the Future, I mean, he's been a public advocate because of his own illness. He's been a public advocate of research in this area. And it can be done through the umbilical cord, for example. There are other sources to get stem cells from, but the more common source is aborted babies. So there would be an example, if we can use this to set up what I'm going to tell you, that the church would say, no, you can't do that because that involves something that's inherently immoral, which is the harvesting of this biological material from unborn babies. Now, in the case of acupuncture, there is nothing there that is in itself inherently immoral. And so let's take a look at what acupuncture does. Now, you would know better than I. I've never had acupuncture, but I know what it is. And by placing the pins in these certain places in the body, you can stimulate the nerves and it can be helpful and give relief from pain, things of that nature. So in itself, there is nothing inherently immoral about doing that. So as a general principle, what the church says is if this is something that a competent doctor suggests for you as a therapy and there's nothing inherently wrong with that therapy, then you would be free to do that. Now, what could impinge upon that would be if it's something that maybe the act itself is not inherently immoral, but let's say that your intention to do this is inherently immoral because you intend to do it. And who knows, if we thought about it, we could come up with some examples of that. But to my understanding, no, there's nothing inherently immoral about making use of acupuncture if it's legitimately prescribed and if it's providing you with healing. And there's nothing in your intention or the circumstances that would involve, say, superstition or anything that would be wrong. I mean, if you were going to a witch doctor, I wouldn't do that. I mean, the circumstances would be askew, that kind of thing. Does that make sense? Do you see what I mean?
Yes, it does. When I was reading online, there were some individuals writing, Catholics, that were saying that it's wrong because it ties to some kind of like spirituality, like Chinese medicine. And like it's called the G or something, where it's related to how everything's connected in your body, whether that's spiritual and physical and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, I don't know much about that. I just wanted to check in.
I wouldn't be concerned about that personally.
Okay.
Now, you know me, I can be Mr. Wet Blanket when it comes to other things that do have a religious connection that are something that would be contrary to the faith, for example. I mean, I would be the first one to say, don't do that. But in my investigations, I've never seen anything that is plausibly saying that or plausibly connected to acupuncture. I mean, different groups can make use of the same things that Catholics do. So there are groups mm-hmm. that make, you know, pagan groups who use incense. Well, the fact that Catholics mm-hmm. use incense doesn't mean that that's somehow pagan. There are groups, even devil worshipers and things will light candles. That doesn't mean that lighting candles is somehow bad now because people can use it in a bad way. So I'm not an expert on this. I don't pretend to be. But if we examine what is the use of acupuncture, is it being used in a clinical setting? It's being recommended by a doctor. It's to help you with, in this case, your infertility. There's no spiritual connection. There's no none of those things are involved, even though somewhere in the world some people might, and I'm not even sure that this is the case, but even if it were the case that somebody somewhere was using acupuncture in a religious ceremony or something, in my estimation, that would be in the same kind of category as, well, maybe that group is using candles or incense or some other thing that you also might see in Christianity. It doesn't mean that your use of it as a Christian is somehow tainted by that. So that's my take on it, Carolyn.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you. Let's see. 888-914-9149. Why don't we pause here? We'll take our break. We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. I'll take any question, within reason, of course, but I'll take any question that's on your mind. And that's the number to call, 888-914-9149. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, we're back, and thanks again for listening. How about Moses now in Conroe, Texas? Good morning, Moses. Is there a Sacred Heart Church in Conroe, Texas?
Yes, there is, Patrick.
I spoke at that church in like 1989. Oh, man. Well, I don't know why I remember these things, but I remember I went to Conroe, Texas to give a weekend event, and as I recall, it was Sacred Heart Church. So I'm glad it's still there.
It is, and we have a new parish now. We joined the parish in 2011, and it's a growing and beautiful church. It's very on fire.
Wonderful. We'll give my regards to the people. They won't have any idea who I am, but I have a fond memory of visiting that parish a long time ago.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for the time. I did have a question regarding, Jesus when he institutes the Eucharist at the Last Supper.
Sure.
I might have a foggy memory of this, but I was watching a video of a priest giving a talk about it. And in that talk, he says that Judas received the sacrament at the Last Supper. And I even remember seeing that in, I think, The Passion of Christ. And the priest was saying he committed a mortal sin, obviously, because then he disposes of the Eucharist when Satan enters him. But my question was, did that happen? And if so, why would Jesus give somebody that's, I guess, in mortal sin communion?
It's a puzzling question that I've thought about myself. And I, too, have gone through the different accounts of the Last Supper in the Gospels to sort this out. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's conclusively clear. I think some people say that it is, that Judas did receive Holy Communion and then left. And some of the phraseology seems to pretty clearly say that he did, but there is a school of thought that he left before that point, like immediately before that point. But let's assume for a minute that he did receive communion. And of course, Jesus knew this. Of course, Jesus knows everything. Why would the Lord give communion to Judas, knowing that he was clearly not in the state of grace? And as a kind of tangent, what does that mean when it comes to the question at a pastoral level nowadays, should a priest give communion to somebody who is a known public sinner? You know, somebody who presents himself for communion, let's say like a, I don't know, like a Speaker of the House or a president or a governor or a senator or somebody who's a Catholic but who openly promotes the evil of abortion, to use that as an example. My understanding is that, number one, Judas's sin, let's kind of take that second part first. Judas's sin was not publicly known. It may have been surmised by the apostles. Jesus certainly knew, but it may have been surmised by some or all of the apostles, but he wasn't at that point yet a public sinner, publicly betraying the Lord, etc. So that would be in keeping with the church's pastoral custom that in the case of somebody who presents himself for Holy Communion and is not publicly, obstinately, manifestly committing a sin, then the priest in good faith, not knowing what's really going on, and how can we know what's really going on in someone's soul, the priest would be within his rights to give Holy Communion. And even in a situation where, let's say, that sinner, I'm going to come back to Judas in just a minute, but I want to connect the dots here between that question and this pastoral issue. Even in the case of, let's say, let's say somebody who's in the state of serious sin and the priest knows it, perhaps because he hears this person's confession and he knows that he keeps falling back into this sin, even in that situation, the priest would not withhold communion, because that could be understood as almost a violation of the seal of confession, because he would be publicly withholding communion from somebody who's coming forward to receive. So that, I want to kind of put that aside, but that's something mm-hmm. that the Judas question relates to indirectly. Why would the Lord do this? I think that among the answers, it would be that the Lord would permit Judas to completely fulfill his role as a betrayer and to allow him to receive Holy Communion at the Last Supper would be the first step in this ultimate betrayal. And it was completed, it culminated in Judas actually in the garden kissing Jesus on the cheek. This is the man you want to arrest, and so forth. So in other words, he completed it, but he really began, and I suppose he began his betrayal earlier than that, because the Lord identifies him as a devil in John chapter 6. So it seems to be this progression leading up to this ultimate betrayal, including betraying the Lord at the Last Supper by receiving communion unworthily. Now, these are all categories and terms that didn't exist in those days. We talk about communion, and that's not a term that the apostles would have used. It's our way of describing what we see in the New Testament there. But my sense of it is that the Lord permitted, just as he permitted that his own body, so we talk about Jesus' present body, blood, soul, and divinity under the appearances of bread and wine at the first Mass at the Last Supper, and at every Mass, everywhere in the world that's celebrated, Jesus also allowed his own body, physically speaking, to be apprehended and whipped and scourged and nailed to a cross. So I see a corollary between the two, that the Lord permitted the violation of his physical body for the purpose of our salvation by his death on the cross. And in so doing, part of his permitting this was to allow the violation of his body, blood, soul, and divinity being consumed by a terrible sinner like Judas. It seems to fit, in other words, that same pattern of the Lord permitting this terrible thing to be done to him.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, that was very helpful.
You know, there are so many really erudite authors who can go much deeper. I'm thinking, for example, take a look at Scott Hahn's book called The Last Supper. I don't recall whether there's anything specifically there about Judas, but he would be an example of a Bible scholar who can give you even more and much deeper insights into these kind of things. I'm not a Bible scholar, so I just give you the tidbits that I have available, but I would refer you to those kind of Bible scholars who can take you much deeper.
Yes, well, thank you. I've met Scott Hahn at a speaking once. He's an incredible speaker, I'll definitely take a look at that.
Okay, that sounds good, Moses. Thank you for that. I have a son-in-law named Moses. All right, let's see. Let's go to Chris in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, I have some knowledge of the time that Jesus spent between his resurrection and ascension, but I would like more. And the understanding I currently have is, if correct, it was a period of 40 days. His time was spent continuing to guide and teach the disciples and inform about the Holy Spirit. And then his ascension occurred at Mount of Olives.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about all I know, and I would like to know more, please.
I'll do my very best. So the first thing I can tell you is that the biblical account does not give us a comprehensive chronological explanation of where Jesus was at any given time. Now, we do have certain punctuated moments where when the apostles went down to Galilee, which, you know, is, we think of it as up because it's north, but they went to Galilee after the crucifixion and resurrection, and they saw Jesus, and he was sitting at the shore. You know the story. This is in Mark chapter 14, for example. They see him, and he's walking on the sea. And they're saying, what is going on here? So they saw him kind of in the sense of his power, his prefigurement. And then after the resurrection, they see him again when they're up there in Galilee, and he's got a fire going, and he's cooking some food. And he says, come and eat with me. Come and sit with me. So we see some amazing things at the Sea of Galilee. This is the final one, where he makes food for them and he eats the food with them. And he says, see that I am not a ghost. It is really I. So moments like that in the upper room where Jesus suddenly appears, he walks through the wall and he appears in the upper room and says to Thomas, for example, the one who didn't believe that Jesus had risen from the dead when the other apostles told him. And he says, put your fingers into the nail wounds in my hands and put your hand into my side so you could see that it's really me. In other words, we see these moments where Jesus appears, and we're told that in one of these instances, upwards of 500 people actually saw Jesus at one time. And these would be people who knew Jesus. They had walked with him. They had listened to his preaching, so they recognized him for who he was. He wasn't like some, you know, a ghost figure or something like that. So my point here is to say the New Testament does tell us certain things that Jesus did, but it doesn't tell us everything he did, and it certainly does not give us a chronological, he was here, and then he went there, and then he went there, and then he went there. We don't have those details. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay, I mean, as far as a chronology... Okay. I just was going to say, as far as a chronology goes, it would be interesting, to say the least, if we had that. But the New Testament is rather scant, those details of what Jesus did. So where did he go? I have to think that Jesus spent a lot of time with his mother. It doesn't say anything about that. But given the few things that it does say about Jesus, what else did he do in that 40-day period of time? I would like to think that he spent time with his mother, consoling her and, you know, and making her very happy knowing that her son Jesus had risen from the dead. Well, thanks for that, Chris. I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go to Shannon now in Folsom, California. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Pat. I was wondering, because my father and I were having a conversation, and my father's 88, and we have heard a lot in the news lately about, well, he follows space and finds it intriguing, but there's been a lot of stuff in the news about, you know, different things happening in the sky. Well, he had mentioned that the black hole had been found to be expanding, and that he wondered, do you think that's all the sinners and all those people going to hell? And I went, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. But I do know that it is expanding because I did read that too. So I said I'd call you and see what Patrick had to say.
Well, I can't say that I would hold any stock in that phenomenon as being somehow connected with the sinners who go to hell. So I've never really given that any thought. So off the cuff, what I would say is it's an interesting analogy if he wants to use it in an analogous way, like just as more and more and more people sadly go to hell. One way of imagining that by way of analogy would be that the black hole swallows more and more and more planets or galaxies or whatever all it's swallowing. But I would see it only merely as an analogy. I don't think there's any, in any way that I can think of, any kind of real connection or correlation between a black hole and sinners going to hell. That I would say, okay. I don't think there is any connection at all. But if it's an analogy or a simile or something, then I could see that.
Yeah, it was just an intriguing thing to think about and something I hadn't thought of. And I was like, wow, Dad, that's deep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've never thought of it that way either. So that's about all I can tell you on that issue. I'm not an expert in astrophysics, so I don't have much to say about black holes. I know they're out there. I hope I never get near one.
Yeah, exactly. Me too.
Black holes can ruin your whole day, as I've heard.
It's science.
Well, thank you, Shannon. I appreciate it. Let's see. Let's go. Do we have time? Yeah, we have time. Let's go to Steve in San Diego. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just have a question about my father. He recently passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And he was, that's all right. He was cremated, and my mother and the rest of my family, I'm the only Catholic in my family. But she split up the ashes and sent some of it to me and some to my brother and his nephew. But the question is, because my daughter was telling me, she's much more religious than me, that I should ask somebody about that because it's not supposed to be done.
Are you a Catholic, Steve? Was your father a Catholic?
Oh, yeah.
My condolences. I'm sorry for your loss. Well, so here's what I can tell you. I only have a brief amount of time. The church says that we are not to scatter the ashes of cremated remains of a loved one because it's not the dignified way in which the remains of the person should be reposed. So the church says you can take the urn of ashes and at a cemetery, Catholic cemetery, ideally, in a mausoleum or a columbarium, and have the urn placed there in a place of respect and honor so that you and your family and your descendants can go and pay the respects there and pray, etc. That's what the church says you should do. So that would be my heartfelt advice. If we didn't have enough time, Steve, and you want to call me tomorrow, feel free to call me back tomorrow. My sincere condolences. I'll be right back with Hour 3.